Hi everybody, today's Monday, June 23rd, 2025, and our friend Carl Jacbo is back with us. Welcome back, Carl.
Thank you for inviting me again. Happy to be back. Thank you.
Carl, I want to start with the American attack on Iran, which was called two attacks on Iran recently. Israeli attack on a rising lion, they call it rising lion, and the American attack, Midnight Hammer. From what we've seen so far from Iranian media, from the analysts, they're saying that the United States attack on Iran has not achieved that much the way that Donald Trump, in the aftermath of the attack, said these were excellent attacks. We destroyed everything. Your take on what has happened in the mind of the Trump administration, or maybe the strategy behind this sort of attack, the United States attack on Iran?
Well, I think, first of all, we have to understand the mechanics within the Trump administration, because a lot of people in the United States at large, but also within the administration, is in fact skeptical about the U.S. intervention in Iran. And to be honest, the problem with Trump is everything is about talking. Everything is kind of a PR thing. And when there is an operation, it's always brilliant, excellent, magnificent, and there's America the best, and nobody can do it better, and things like this. So that sounds to me a little bit like the guy who sells a used car, a secondhand car, you know? So everything is beautiful and all that, even if the content is just crap. And that's a little bit how I read Donald Trump. There is a lot of show, but not much content. And we have seen that not just in that particular case with Iran, but also in the whole issue of the tariffs and the war in Ukraine. He was ready to solve the problem in 24 hours, in 10 days or whatever. And he had the solution. He had the most brilliant experts for the tariffs that would bring the America first again within days. And finally, we noticed that he had, in fact, probably an idea about an objective, but he has no strategy to achieve the objective. He doesn't know how to achieve what he wants to achieve. And therefore, everything he does fails. And my personal view in that particular case of the Midnight Hammer operation, my feeling is that he did it, and I'm convinced he doesn't like Iran, as he doesn't like Russia, as he doesn't like China. But at the same time, I think he went into that operation reluctantly, in my view. And if you study the operation, sometimes you have the feeling that it was an operation without a real objective. And therefore, they did the minimal service, if you want. They were probably under pressure by Israel and the Israeli community or the Israel supporters, or you can call it as you want, the lobby, Israel lobby in the US and things like that. And you have many within the administration, including people like Lindsey Graham and Richard Blumenthal and that kind of people. And probably felt obliged to do something. And even it's this something was a very expensive something, I'm not sure it was designed to have a definitive success. And it was announced days before, at least the Iranians could anticipate that this would happen. A lot of people said this will happen, and even Seymour Hersh wrote an article saying this would happen during the weekend. Therefore, there were a lot of foreknowledge about this, and apparently, as we can see from satellite pictures, especially in Fordo, I've seen the pictures, the Iranians have managed to get most sensitive equipment and even personnel away from the installation. And so basically what the Americans did was to attack some kind of empty structures. Although, to be honest, we don't know exactly what the extent of the damage is. There are some information coming from Iran, but I don't know. Understandably, the Iranian government will play down some damages, and the U.S., Israeli will exaggerate the success. So I don't know exactly where we stand. In any case, what we can assess from the information we have is that there are not significant damage caused. And, you know, we also have to remember that Iran has been prepared for such an eventuality for decades. I mean, they are literally decades that the Americans are threatening attacking these nuclear facilities. There have been some attempts, by the way, by the Israeli in the past. Therefore, we know that it could be a threat. And I can assume that the Iranians are not stupid. They probably put their facilities deep enough in order to avoid even those deep penetrating bombs, the GBU 57 or something like that. I may be wrong on that, but in any case, those deep penetrating bombs, which go up to probably 10, 20 meters deep. And my view is that probably the Iranians have anticipated that and put the facilities deeper than 20 meters. Well, let's put it that way. And that's probably what we have here. That's the military side of it. But there is something more consequential, I think, that we have to understand, is that as it happened with the Israeli attack, the Rising Lion on the 13th of June, we have now an attack that happens in the middle of a process, a negotiation process. On 13th of June, that was the process that was due to happen, or in the process of in Oman, and this time it was the process with the European Troika. The British, the German, and the French in Geneva about the same topic. And this was a process in Geneva. So in both cases, the Israeli and the U.S. have short-circuited a diplomatic process that could have resulted or not. The thing is, here are two things. First of all, the idea of striking Iran during the process is some kind of mafia-like or terrorist, because we can call it that way too, a way to impose a solution, meaning that this is what we want to achieve, and as long as you don't agree with that, we'll strike. We'll strike you. And this is not the way you do negotiations. This idea of using the military force to coerce one party into a solution is, in my view, not what we should do, especially when we talk about the so-called civilized world, or, you know, with the rule of law and all these kind of things. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that all the installation of facilities that have been stricken by the Israelis on one hand, even the Israelis also attacked some civilian targets. So I'm talking about the nuclear-related facilities. Those struck by the Israelis and those struck by the Americans were all facilities that have been inspected by the IAEA, meaning that we have institutional international law sanctioned body that has access to the facilities, who knows what the status of things there. And still, we consider that these, the IAEA in that case, has not fulfilled its task by doubling down with some military action. And in my view, this is a way somehow to sabotage the complete international law system and law and monitoring system. And this is, in fact, the US has constantly short-circuited international institutions, in fact, sabotaged the work of institutions. We can even talk about the ICC, for instance, that is, the US is not even party of that, but they sanctioned the ICC because they had this arrest warrant against Netanyahu, for instance. So we see that we use those international institutions not as a tool for regulation of the life, you know, we'd say the international life or international relations, but as a way, as a leverage to punish or not the people we want to punish. And we don't take into account the stabilizing effect of these institutions, because IAEA is precisely there to avoid military operations, avoid such operation that Midnight Hammer. Therefore, there is something conceptually wrong in all that. We should use military force when all the rest has failed, you know, not as a substitute, a convenient substitute in order to impose a solution, as the US does. Same thing with the NPT, for instance. You know, it's very strange that, and we'll probably talk about it when we talk about the consequences of what is happening. But Iran is sanctioned because it has signed the NPT. Well, Israel can allow itself whatever it wants because it didn't sign the NPT. So there's an essential contradiction here. International law-based order that works only for some and not for others. And this is not the way we can manage international relations. You know, it's exactly the same as if in a country you have people who, for some reason, can escape the law and therefore make their own law to some other, you know. Everybody would see that as unjust, and everybody would see that as a disruption of the rule of law. So why do we accept that in international relations and we don't when it comes to national laws? So there is something distorted here. And I think what the Americans have done here is just to accentuate this problem, this failure of international law-based order. Of course, this is replaced today by what we have discussed many times on your channel, by the international rules-based order, that in fact say, well, it's not a law that is the unit of measure, but it's just the rules that we have decided. And that brings me to something that I have already mentioned on your channel. And again, I come from, my background is strategic intelligence. Strategic intelligence is the intelligence that is provided to the strategic decision makers, in my case, was the Swiss government, Swiss general staff, things like this. So when you come with an assessment of the situation, you know that this assessment cannot just be a fantasy or your opinion or things like that. It has to be fact-based, because based on this assessment, people will take decisions. Now, what we have seen last week is quite interesting, because as we have discussed, I think that was last week, that the US intelligence community has assessed in March, I mean, it is annual threat assessment that was published in the end of March this year. They assessed that the Iran had no nuclear bombs and had not even made the decision to have one. And when Donald Trump, as he was flying back from the G7 summit to the US, he was asked by a journalist how he would assess what Tulsi Gabbard said as DNI. She was, of course, presenting the assessment of the intelligence community. And he said, "I don't care about Tulsi Gabbard says. I know that Iran has a bomb," something like that. So meaning that we are now in something which is quite odd, especially when we talk about the rule of law, when we talk about rational decision-making, fact-based decision-making, and things like this. We have the leader of one of the biggest countries in the world that decides not on the base of the institutions that are precisely designed and equipped and trained to make assessment of the situation, but he based his decision on its own gut feeling. So we are back in the 17th century or something like that in Europe, when the kings were inspired by God in their decision. This is exactly what triggered the various revolutions that we had in Europe prompted by the so-called Enlightenment period. Enlightenment means that you enlighten the decision, meaning that your decision becomes based on facts, based on national interest, based on something that concrete that you can document, that you can assess, that not just on God's inspiration. I mean, God must inspire us in the sense that it should guide our, our path in the sense of the ethics, of the morale, of the sense of justice in all that. But when it comes to concrete decision, this must be based on facts, you know, on the reality of the facts. And that's exactly that's why we had all the revolution between the 17th and 18th century in Europe. Well, when we listen to Trump, we are back to these years. And that's extremely, that's something that is a source of concern to me. We have seen that, by the way, in the last 3 years, when it comes to the conflict in Ukraine and Russia, everything is responsible. I mean, you even before the you probably didn't hear that, but before the Olympic Games in Paris, some noticed that in the beds of the hotels in Paris, you had kind of an infection of insects. And they were proliferating in Paris. Don't ask me why. And so, I mean, the French government found why. That was Putin who came with the insects in the French hotel bedrooms. You know, this is beyond rationality. And of course, this has become a subject of laughing. I mean, everybody laughs at this in France, but the government said it seriously, not as a joke. So we are in a period, and I think, again, as it comes just to talk on TV and all that, that's funny, and we can laugh about it, no problem. When it translates into military action, bombing individuals, killing people and all that, that's no longer funny. But the decision-making process remains the same. And that is something that should worry us as citizens, regardless where we are. Because as we can notice, especially in the Western world, decision-making is guided by this kind of irrational way of thinking. I mean, again, this is we are managing things by gut feeling and not by proper intellectual assessment of facts. And that's something we cannot accept, you know? And we see that this kind of extremely poor decision-making is then must be accompanied by censorship, because you have to prevent any other kind of rational assessment to interfere with what. So I think this is something that this crisis reveals beyond all the facts we can see. This is the irrationality of decision making, and this is the endangering of the international order that we have established after World War II. And the purpose of having an international law-based order was precisely to avoid this kind of decision-making that led to World War II, in fact. And we are close to that today. So this is something that worries me considerably. And we see that the intelligence services apparently are not strong enough, or maybe convincing enough, in order to influence the decision making. And what I have also noticed when I studied the covert wars in Ukraine is that, in fact, we are slightly moving into another direction, that the intelligence structures are, in fact, used to justify the wrongdoing somehow. And instead of using intelligence, I mean, in a country, in a working, in a functional country, intelligence should provide the ultimate information, that the information which is the most factually based information. That's the purpose of the intelligence. This is the purpose. This is the central point of intelligence. I remind you that intelligence, the word intelligence, comes from Latin intelligere, which means to understand. So intelligence is not about killing people, topping government and all that, even if they also do that. But the essential purpose is to understand the situation and to understand it properly. But today we misuse the reputation of intelligence services by distorting the facts and trying to use the intelligence organization in order to justify a distortion of facts. Because the intelligence, when you want to be convincing, you say, well, the intelligence services told me that. Even the CIA said that. Not that. Because the intelligence should be the absolute baseline when it comes to the quality of information. But now we are misusing that. And this is exactly what we have seen recently. The intelligence structures were not listened to. And that's something that also indicates a serious flaw in the management, in the governance of our countries at large. So these are beyond the military result or the bombing and casualties and all that. Beyond that, that's what I think is something we should be worried about. Again, it doesn't exclude the rest, but a lot of people have already commented on the destruction of infrastructure and all that. And all that is true and all that. I don't want to comment on that. But there are other factors that we need to take into consideration. This is the decay of our governance systems in the West, you know?
Carol, in Iran, we know that Iranian foreign minister right now is in Russia talking with the Russian president. And in Iran, what's going on? They're talking about the communication with IAEA. They want to stop this communication. They want to get out of NPT. And the American strike on Iran didn't achieve because they said that Iran has 400 kilogram of enriched uranium that is able, that by this amount Iran is able to produce nuclear weapons. No sign of destroying any of this, even with the nuclear facilities. They have emptied everything inside the facility. Do you think that this would somehow bring a new sort of confrontation between East and the West? Because I don't see, Russia said, what the president of Russia said during the international, they had a conference in St. Petersburg, the International Economic Forum in St. Petersburg. Vladimir Putin said that Russia and Iran are fighting the same forces. And today in his meeting with the Iranian foreign minister said, we are in together in this fight. What is going on when it comes to the mindset of Russia, China, and Iran right now? Iran, it seems that this somehow they're feeling that the only way to deal with the West is to be stronger, to go against them. Your take on that?
Well, first of all, we have to talk about these 400 kilograms of enriched uranium and things like this, because in the JCPOA, I mean, first of all, Iran has an inalienable right to enrich uranium. This is stated as such in the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And the JCPOA based it, one of the his article, on this particular right specified in the Non-Proliferation Treaty, meaning that Iran has the right to enrich uranium. Now, the enrichment process cannot be stopped when you start it. And according to the JCPOA, Iran was allowed to enrich uranium to a certain level and to have to sell this, I mean, because this enriched uranium for use in Iran for domestic purposes. But of course, the enrichment process cannot be stopped. Iran must sell that outside. It's part of the export. I mean, it exports enriched uranium for civilian purposes, medical or electricity energy production and things like this. And according to the JCPOA, Iran was allowed to have a buffer stock of 300 kilos. And the JCPOA was signed in 2015. And during the following years, IAEA inspected the Iran, and Iran was in full compliance with the treaty. And I think 1 or 2 years after, as stipulated in the JCPOA, sanctions should have been lifted by the Western countries and the US in particular. Now, what happened is that the US withdrew in 2019 from the treaty and imposed new sanctions, prohibiting the export of uranium, meaning that this uranium could no longer be exported as previously. No sanctions were lifted because the other partners of the treaty didn't dare to do that because they were fearing the reaction of the US. And therefore, although Iran was entitled to have all the sanctions lifted because it was in full compliance, the sanctions remained. And for that reason, Iran said, well, I don't feel bound by the treaty anymore because nobody respects the treaty. I mean, the US have withdrawn, and the others don't dare to lift the sanctions. And the Americans have added new sanctions. So we were in a situation, again, it's a total disruption of international law. And that led the Iranian to enrich more than was stipulated in the JCPOA for commercial purposes. And it's important to say that the maximum enrichment that was reached by the Iranian was 60%. To my knowledge, they haven't gone beyond that. And going beyond that, I mean, the military grade uranium should be 90% and plus. Now, from 60% to 90%, it requires a technology and a process that is extremely complex, because the more you enrich your uranium, the more refined must be your system, and it's even more expensive and all that. But to my knowledge, the Iranian have never produced military-grade enriched uranium. But they enrich their uranium in order to sell it for different purposes as an exportation product. And of course, at the same time, the 300 kilograms buffer storage was reached 400. I mean, we are not talking about something extraordinary. The problem is that, and if you have noted, when the Americans started the Operation Hammer, Midnight Hammer, short after the beginning of the operation, Kaya Kallas, the foreign minister of the EU, and then Ursula von der Leyen, the president of the European Commission, tweeted that a tweet about the to explain why the US was justified in attacking Iran. But the first line, the very first line of the tweet for both of them was, we cannot allow Iran to have the nuclear bomb. So for most people, the whole discussion is, and the discussion that was happening in Geneva, by the way, for most people, it was about Iran wanting the bomb and the West doesn't want that. But it was not the issue. The issue that was in discussion in Geneva was not about having the bomb or not. Iran has stated many times that they don't want the bomb. They never had a military nuclear program. We can come back to this later, but they never had such a program, and they didn't ask for having the possibility of having a bomb. What they want is to have the possibility to enrich uranium as an inalienable right. Now, what the Americans want, what the Israeli want, and therefore what the European want, is that Iran should not make any type of uranium enrichment. So stop every single enrichment activity, which is against international law. And that is what is at stake in, that was what was at stake in Oman, and that with the Americans, in the dialogue with the Americans in Oman, and that's exactly what was at stake with the, in the discussion with the Europeans in Geneva. So it's not about having the bomb or not. It's being authorized or having, I mean, to having the right to enrich uranium or not. And not, we are not talking about 3%, 10%, 20%. It's not about a percent. The European or the West doesn't want Iran to enrich uranium at all. In fact, to renounce to a right that is stipulated in the Non-Proliferation Treaty as inalienable. And that's the reason why Iran has a very firm stance on this. Because it has signed an agreement, it always complied with this agreement, I mean, the NPT. But in this special document is authorized to enrich uranium for civilian purposes, what Iranian has done, and that has been demonstrated by the various inspections of the IAEA. So you see here that the West is distorting the reality. We shifted the issue from authorization, I mean, the legitimate right to enrich uranium, from that to having a nuclear bomb. And that's how the head of the European Commission, so that shows the level of disinformation. Because the head of the European Commission, which is essentially the head of the European Union, if you want, still considers that what is at stake is Iran having a bomb or not, and therefore justifying military operation. This is something which is absolutely insane. You know, we are dealing with people who are totally irrational. And that's, we are back to what I said before. This is exactly the problem here, that we are distorting the reality. The Iranians have never said, now you should authorize us to have a nuclear bomb. First of all, they would not ask for that, probably. And now, of course, the West want to prevent that. Therefore, what is the consequence? Having a nuclear weapon would probably act as a deterrent. And by the way, you had a document that was produced by the RAND Corporation. I don't know if I have it here, just to show the cover page, probably. I think this is this one. Sorry, it's in French, but the date is in French, but the title is Dangerous But Not Omnipotent, which is a study of the RAND Corporation produced or published in 2008 about the strategic posture of Iran. In this document, they explain that Iran has no nuclear weapon, which is not a surprise, but they also say that had Iran a nuclear weapon, it would not be to attack Iran or whoever, it would be for deterrence purposes. Because what they explain in that document is that deterrence is the central aspect of the Iranian security policy. Therefore, they even acknowledge that Iran has no intent or ambitions or whatever policy to attack the rest of the Middle East, but they just want to deter an external operation, which in fact makes sense because they have been threatened since decades. And what we have seen in the last week is exactly why the Iranians would need a deterrence capacity. Meaning that, on the one hand, because we misuse the NPT to prevent Iran to have its legitimate goal for for enriching or legitimate practice of enriching uranium. And on the other hand, the NPT prevents Iran to have a, let's say, nuclear deterrence capacity. Why would Iran stay in the NPT? And that's why you have so many voices in Iran to say, well, we cannot trust the West. They don't even, they can't even read what they read, write. They cannot even implement or accept what they have signed, you know? So why should Iran still comply with the NPT? And therefore, it would make a lot of sense, especially after what happened in the last 10 days, it would make a lot of sense for Iran just to say, we quit the NPT and we have our policy and go away. So that since the IAEA is not even able to explain the world that Iran is complying, I mean, there are probably some issue in the compliance. I can agree with that, but I don't know. But mostly is in the issue of reports. It's about the reporting. It's about details. It's not about the fundamentals. And that's also what Iran is complaining about the IAEA, because you on the 12th of June, one day before the Israeli operation, the IAEA has issued a report on non-compliance of Iran. But when you read the report, you don't really understand what exactly is non-compliant with. It refers to reporting, which is probably inaccurate, or things like this, things that you can clarify differently. But obviously, we are not talking about the fundamentals of the application of the NPT. So we play with words, and that's also something the Russians have complained about, by the way, because IAEA was involved in the problem related to the Zaporozhye nuclear power plant in Ukraine. And here again, IAEA tried to have kind of ambiguous language in order to satisfy the pressures of the West, instead of being scientifically neutral, if you want, fact-based. They tried to have this ambiguous language just to please the West. And of course, this is also something that we have seen in the past, that when you go to these UN agencies, they are led by people coming from usually large countries or large contributors of the UN. And of course, as soon as this person decides something that is not in line with what the West wants, well, we start to talk about the fact that he may have made some kind of harassment or misbehavior and things like this, and we discard the person. I mean, again, I will not take or protect or defend the director of the ICC, but you may remember that as soon as they issued this arrest warrant against Netanyahu, then suddenly he was, you know, charged of harassment and misconduct and things like this. Before, nobody talked about this. When he made the arrest warrant against Vladimir Putin, he was a very fine guy. But as soon as it was against Netanyahu, then he became to be a bad guy. And that's exactly the problem we have here. These people, they are probably selected for that, by the way. They don't have a strong personality. They can be pressured. And this is exactly what you have with Rafael Grossi. These individuals are not, they are not, let's say, they cannot, how to say that? We cannot say they have integrity. They are not marked by integrity. If you are a person with integrity, you can resist those pressure. And you say, well, if you don't agree with me, I go away. But because my task, my duty, my task is based on the fact says so, and that's what I tell you in good faith and with all the best of my knowledge, but I'm not complying with any pressure. My decision or my action, my assessment or whatever, is based exclusively on facts. And this is the way it should go. Those agencies, which are essentially technical agencies of the UN, such as the IAEA, the OPCV, and things like this, these are agencies which should be guided by facts, with individuals that are marked by integrity and the ability to resist pressure. I mentioned the OPCV because that was exactly the same issue that happened in 2013 with Syria, and I don't remember the name of the ambassador who was leading the OPCV at that time. I think he was a French ambassador, but obviously he was pressured by Western countries to convey a certain language that would open the door for the accusation against the Assad regime. And that he had even problem within the organization, because some individuals said, no, this is not the way it should be. And you had dissidents, they were expelled, of course, and they tried to express the reality of the facts and not a political reality. These agencies should not be political. They should be factual. The politics come afterwards, but the assessment should be factual. And that's exactly the problem here. Apparently, I don't know, again, maybe I cannot verify 100% the information, but apparently the director of the IAEA agreed to share the names and location of some Iranian scientists who incidentally were killed on the 13th of June. So this is something that has, I mean, extraordinary importance, in fact, because this is the whole credibility of the international order that is at stake here. And we are back to exactly what I said before. The West is corrupting the international law-based order in order to replace it with this international rule-based order, where the West established the rules, and these rules are accepted by the West only. And that's exactly what we are witnessing today with Iran. And that's something that is, in my view, totally unacceptable. And that's not related. Again, I'm not Iranian. Some other people can judge better the situation in Iran. I cannot. And to be honest, this is not my business. This is beyond the point here. Here we are talking about something very precise. This is international security, is this international nuclear security, I would say. And this is about this, whether Khamenei has a black dress, a white dress, or something, I don't care. This is not the issue. And this is where we see this, where the corruption in the West is going, because in fact, behind all this, and this was repeated, and that was even mentioned in, I think the Washington Post mentioned that, because after the half failure of the Operation Midnight Hammer, now they are considering a regime change in Iran. I mean, Trump is thinking about regime change in Iran, because at the end of the day, it goes about that, you know. And that's exactly where we are at stake. I mean, we are exactly in opposition to the UN Charter. In the UN Charter, you don't care who leads the country XYZ, whether it's a good or bad leader. By the way, if it were a bad leader, we could eliminate all the European leaders. But we don't do that because they are conveniently stupid. The thing is that what is behind all this is, at the end of the day, the subversion against Iran. And all we see about all this assertion that I recently listened to a Swiss journalist who said that Iran had a nuclear program in the late 50s in order to bomb its neighbors. You know, in the late 50s, Iran had a government that has been installed by the US and the British, by the way, and was part of the Western Bloc with all the neighboring countries. So why should Iran wanting to destroy its neighbors since they were all belonging to the same club, if you want? In addition to that, the nuclear program in Iran was established in the late 50s with the help of the Americans. So the Americans were feeding Iran to bomb neighbors who are the closest ally to the US. You know, and that's where you see this inconsistency that we have among even journalists, who, by the way, is self-portrayed as an expert on Iran. So we are beyond rationality here at every level. And that is where I think a citizen, regardless of the country, but when we belong to a citizen, we cannot accept to have people who behave irrationally for interest we don't know where they come from and where they head to. Because, as you rightly said, Putin said, we fight against the same forces. Who are these forces? And we see that we have consistently, since about 30 years now, and probably more in fact, but notably in the last 30 years, by listening to these forces, we have disrupted a whole region. We have killed millions of people, displaced millions of people, create more harm than anybody else in history, because this is massive that we have done. And just for the sake of these forces, you know, it's not even the interest. I mean, when I see my country, Switzerland, was supposed to be neutral, or is supposed to be neutral, did they complain or condemn the US operation in Iran or the Israeli operation in Iran? No. Even if, basically, traditionally, the compliance with the international law was a basis of Swiss foreign policy, which is exactly compatible with neutrality. Neutrality is not about being right or left or blue or white or whatever. It's about having the rule of law and about compliance with the international law. Period. That's neutrality. You can be blue, and if you don't comply, you don't comply. If you are white, you don't comply. That means you don't comply, and you can be blamed for that. That's neutrality. Neutrality is not saying nothing about things. It's precisely, especially if international law is the, your core business, or the defense and the protection of international law is your core business, then we have to do. But Switzerland conveniently didn't condemn. We condemned, of course, what happened on the 7th of October, 2023, what the Russians have done in the 24th of February, 2022, and all that. But the operation, the Israeli and the US operation against Iran, which are blatant violation of international law, violation of the UN Charter, are not condemned. So that means we are beyond neutrality here. And I think the example, this example of Switzerland exemplifies the failure of the West at large. Because in the past, during the Cold War, we thought that we were better than the Communist Bloc or Warsaw Pact, you can call him as you want, but we were better because we had the rule of law, because we had those democratic laws, and because we could have this kind of transparency in acting according to the wish of the population and things like that. We are not authoritarian, we are not undemocratic and things like this. And today, what are we seeing? We are seeing exactly the opposite. We have totally failed. And I'm happy, to be honest, no longer belonging to the intelligence service today, because I would probably be dismissed within minutes, because this is not what the spirit, this is not the philosophy, this is not what we had in mind at the time. The way we managed the Cold War was probably good, probably bad, I don't know, and history will tell. But at least we could manage to keep kind of a democratic type of governance. Everybody could express itself. As I said many times, you could buy the Pravda in the papers or news outlets in Switzerland, in France, and elsewhere. So, although we are fighting against the Warsaw Pact, people could still be communist in our countries. Today, we are not only preventing any inconvenient narrative, or the narrative that doesn't follow the official one. But our leadership doesn't behave rationally, behave according to objective that nobody really can understand and can follow and accept, by the way. Well, we usually don't ask them, so that's easier also. And we have also a society that accepts that, also have to say so. In the 60s and the 70s, you had demonstrations all over against the war in Vietnam and elsewhere. And okay, I don't know if that was useful or not. I was not a part of that, but you could do that. Today, if you have a demonstration for Palestine, you're accused of terrorism. As my uncle, who was in the French resistance during World War II, he was considered as a terrorist by the Germans. Everything that was opposed to the official rule was considered as terrorist. And we have exactly the same thing today. So there is something deeply wrong in our societies. And I think beyond what's happening and the exchange of missiles and the success of this missile exchange, with this whole issue questions the very fundamentals of our societies. But anyway.
Thank you so much, Carl, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always, have you on.
That was my pleasure. Thank you very much for inviting me.